Hi, welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host today, Tom Cook. By way of background for today's episode, I spent 24 years in the U.S. Air Force, with 16 of those leading development, launch, and operations of our nation's military satellite systems. After retiring in 2017, I began consulting for space startups until co-founding a new company in 2020 called Spacely, an open talent marketplace serving the aerospace industry. I'm thrilled to also be joined today by my brilliant co-host, John Rask, and I'll pass the mic over to him to provide a short introduction now. John?
Hello, everyone. John Rask, NASA Ames Research Center. I've been at Ames for over 23 years and studied life sciences, space biology, and human research, and have contributed to laboratory and field work.
Fantastic. Thank you, John. So in today's episode, we want to talk about how the science of systems is becoming increasingly critical to the advancement of society and how we live and work amongst new technology and rapid advancements. Today, we're talking with Dr. David Bray. Dr. Bray is both a distinguished fellow at the nonpartisan Henry L. Stimson Center, non-resident distinguished fellow with the Business Executives for National Security, and a CEO and transformation leader for different under-the-radar tech and data ventures seeking to get started in novel situations. He's also principal at Lead, Do, Adapt Ventures and has served in a variety of leadership roles in turbulent environments, including bioterrorism preparedness and response from 2000 to 2005, executive director for a bipartisan national commission on R&D, providing nonpartisan leadership as a federal agency senior executive, work with the U.S. Navy and Marines on improving organizational adaptability, and with U.S. Special Operation Command's J5 Directorate on the challenges of countering disinformation online. So welcome, Dr. Bray. Today, the speed at which technology is being developed, adopted, and overall made accessible to larger groups of people can lead to greater productivity and prosperity, but can also be destabilizing and turbulent. Environmental turbulence, new systems insights, and anomalous detections, and what this all means to the health and wellness of ecosystems is a major part of what we'll be covering today. Dr. Bray, thanks again so much for joining us today. I'll get us started with the first question to you here. As we think through a world where industry and society are increasingly informed by ecosystems and relationships, the bounty of potential benefit and risk is amplified in this kind of environment. How can systems thinking help us better frame the connective tissue of ecosystems, policies, infrastructure, incentive structures, frameworks, and more?
Well, great to be here with you, Tom, and thanks to be here with the conversation and have a chance to give input as to why we need to think about, as you said, a science of systems. And so maybe I'll sort of step back and first talk about ecosystem approaches. What do we mean by ecosystem approaches? Because some people might think we're talking about environmental ecosystems, and that's clearly part of it. But it's also thinking about whether they're social or economic systems, whether it's thinking about technology ecosystems, or even just systems of how different societies relate to each other. And I raise that because what makes an ecosystem different than a hierarchy is the idea that an ecosystem has sort of emergent behaviors that will come out of it. Whereas a hierarchy is very good at sort of top-down control and predictability, when we're talking about an ecosystem, we need to recognize that it's sort of grounded in complex adaptive systems, that the agents actually have their own sort of rule sets and behaviors that they do, but then the behavior of the overall system is in some respects emergent and beyond just what the individual agents could do themselves. And so as we look to the world we're in, the good news is we've never had more than, we're at 8 billion people on the planet. That's great. And we seem to be, for the most part, thriving. But we've also created new challenges in the sense that the good news is we reduced infant mortality. Challenging news is now we have youth bulges and unemployed youth in certain parts of the world that we have to address. Even after we solve that, then as we actually get them jobs, the challenging news is now we have to deal with the pollutants associated with the jobs that they're doing. And so we have, in some respects, past successes that sets ourselves up for new challenges that have second, third, and fourth order effects that only by looking through the lens of a science of systems, we can begin to better understand and address. The other thing I would say is I often ask, what is different about our now than say 50 years ago or 100 years ago or 150 years ago? And what I would say is different about our now, aside from the fact that we have an unprecedented number of people on the planet, is that we have made technology democratized. It's now more accessible and available that people can do things using space technologies, including some of the things that you used to do, Tom, just 15 or 20 years ago, using biotechnologies that sort of, John, I know you've had a background as well. People can now do things that only large nation states could do 15 or 20 years ago, are now increasingly in the hands of companies, and in some cases, individuals as well. That's tremendously empowering, when you can actually do bio and space at that scale. But it's also incredibly challenging because we have not built a system of international norms, much less local and civil norms, to be able to deal with this. We may face a future 10 years from now where an aggrieved spouse is having a divorce and they go to divorce court and they say, you said you were going to the grocery store, but I pulled the satellite records and I can see you really went somewhere else. Do we want that future? Or a future in which all of us may go for a job interview and we're ethical, but someone else in a job interview is wanting to knock out the competition. So they get a hold of our DNA and they make it so that we're not deathly ill, but it makes it so that for the next 2 or 3 days, we're out of commission. Who's going to investigate that type of crime if that type of crime happens where your own biology was used against you? And so this is the world we're going into where unprecedented capabilities can be done by companies and individuals. That's tremendously empowering for the human species, but it also means we have to approach things differently, that we can't have point solutions or band-aid solutions to the problem. We really do have to take a system, a science of systems approach in how we think about where we want to go together.
That's really fascinating. And I'd like to jump in here from a biological perspective. It seems that everything matters in biological ecosystems when we study them biologically. Every single element matters. And having some kind of an awareness across all the different systems is so key to moving that system forward. And as you pointed out, we can imagine a dystopian future for humanity, or perhaps we can also imagine a utopian future. So how, using this science of systems, how do communities come closer together? How would we make and work with people to bring them together to do this?
Absolutely. And I'm a big believer. I'm an optimist. I believe that if you want to have a positive change in the world, you have to be an optimist. Pessimists are very good at admiring the problem, but it's really the optimist that, you know, you can be an informed optimist that are daring enough to try and actually do something about it. And so when I look at biology, I am ultimately convinced that biology is how we're going to be able to solve the challenges associated with climate change and the impact that we're having on the planet. And what do I mean by that? There's some evidence, and we need to probably gather more evidence, that we've lost a lot of the nitrogen-fixing bacteria in our soils because of overuse in terms of agricultural practices. Now, nobody's going to say stop agriculture, because that would be stopping food and we have to feed the planet. But we've got to figure out a way to return nitrogen-fixing bacteria to the soil. And so when I think about a science of systems approach, I would use air and space-based assets to first just even characterize the problem. Like, can we actually see from space the loss of nitrogen-fixing bacteria? And if you can show to the world that maybe you've lost 80 to 90% of the bacteria from the soil, if we had lost 80% or 90% of the trees on the planet, people would be clamoring for plant more trees. Well, if we can actually begin to characterize the problem, then the next step is, okay, well, what do we do about it? Well, there are natural bacteria that are not only good at actually returning nitrogen to the soil, but in some cases can actually pull methane either from the air or liquid sources as their source. And they'll use that as a sugar. So they'll pull methane, which is actually good to get out of the atmosphere anyway, because that's actually worse than carbon dioxide, somewhere between 40 to 22 times worse, depending on your time scale, as opposed to CO2. So you could actually solve the problem of methane in the air while at the same time return nitrogen to the soil. And then even better, you can then do another flyby using a space or air-based asset to show, look, job done. And once you've done the job done, then people can actually see an impact and they can actually have hope. And so I think that thinking about bio, thinking about space, thinking about data, the way we're going to solve the challenges we've created. And again, I'm a big believer these challenges exist because of past successes, that we've reduced infant mortality, that we are finding jobs for people. And so nobody wants to go back to an era in which we had those problems. But now we have a new set of problems, which is how do we deal with our footprint as a species on the planet? And we'll solve that. And I'm sure we're going to have something else we're going to have to solve and something else we're going to have to solve. But that's the nature of humanity and getting ahead of those curves. And then recognizing at the end of the day, it's not going to be one sector that solves it. When things were less interconnected, maybe you could say, yeah, sure, that's the job of a government. Or maybe, yeah, that's the job of just a private sector. Or maybe that's the job of a nonprofit. What I just described to you is going to involve all of them. It's going to involve possibly private companies that can help do the assessment. It's going to be governments thinking about how you set the framework. It may even be eventually how communities actually can get credit for actually returning nitrogen to the soil. And so that's also going to require a science of systems for how we do effective policymaking, which right now, quite frankly, as much as I love economics, will not be the sole solution to this. We need to actually have a systematic approach to understand the linkages and the incentives to motivate the behaviors we want.
And how do we convince the people who are stubborn, who don't want to do this?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I don't necessarily know if you have to convince them. In some respects, I think, again, when have we ever as a species been completely united as to what we want to do? but it doesn't mean that you have to convince everybody, say, to think about the old days where we wanted to lower infant mortality. I think most people would agree it was important, but some people would say, well, why do I need to spend money on that versus other things like that? And so if you look at the planet as sort of a dynamic, complex, adaptive system itself, you can have some agents that say, I'm willing to take this cause on. Other people that say, I want to focus someplace else, and that's okay. And actually the solution will be. And so I think what we need to do is recognize that we don't need to have everyone united in what we need to do, but instead have almost a marketplace of ideas and try to do a do no harm principle. I do worry that when we start engaging in geoengineering, there might be some people that have not gone through a vetting process and were surprised that their geoengineering approach is not the best, but have a marketplace of ideas and therefore move forward collectively. The other thing I think that's missing from the conversation, particularly about climate change at the moment, is oftentimes you have climate experts, but you don't have job and policy people present in the room, or you have job and policy people present without climate people in the room. I'd love to create a new discipline. I don't know what I would call it, and I'd probably come up with a mismatched name, but thinks about how we can solve climate while at the same time actually create more jobs. And it's not just about greenification of jobs, but it is exactly what I said. It's about how do you instrument the planet to better understand what's happening. And the reality is if we instrument the planet to understand what's happening in terms of climate change, we do the same thing for public health. In a past life, as you sort of heard, I did bioterrorism preparedness and response. And one of the ways we knew about the original coronavirus, SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome in 2002, 2003, we knew about it 5.5 months before China said anything because increased reflectivity of cars and parking lots around certain hospitals. So we weren't tracking individual people, but we knew enough of the planet to say, wait, something's odd going around here. There's more cars around parking lots. The other thing that we also knew was the price of garlic had gone up tenfold. Garlic seen as a cure-all in Southeast Asia. So when you see a price spike like that, tells you something. Well, sure enough, you fast forward to COVID-19 and the early days of COVID-19, increased cars around parking lots and increased spiking of the price of garlic. So we could instrument the planet and almost have the equivalent of private sector provided what I would call smoke detectors for change of any type. Change of public health, change in climate, change in instability or food insecurity, because we know food instability, in my opinion, is actually our biggest concern. If you look at some of the early conflicts that have happened in the last decade or two, they have roots associated with people not getting enough food or starting to do migratory behaviors, and that then creates social stresses that creates other problems. And so I think about that, can we have the equivalent of smoke detectors for the 21st century that are understanding what the planet is doing, not just for climate change, but to get ahead of a future pandemic, to help with food security, and to better understand just what we are doing as a planet together.
Fascinating.
Yeah, so let's talk about the government's role here a little bit. I grew up and we were looking at, in our area outside of DC, where there's obviously a ton of policy being made there, right? And Virginia had a lot of local policies early on, early 1900s, that were about, hey, let's create new infrastructure, allow new commerce to exist. And in that area, folks said, okay, the government is here to help us flourish, right? So in these systems, when you look at safety versus advancement and prosperity, where do you see the government's role in providing inputs or courses of action in the system of systems where you include academia and private industry? And then again, who's taking lead here? And how's it seems to me from what you're saying that the government might be lead here in one point of input into this ecosystem, whereas they may be a contributor in another section. What are your thoughts on the government's role in the overall system of systems approach?
So I think we are living history and we're trying to figure out what those roles are. And I would say it's worth, you mentioned like sort of the 1900s, and that was a time in which, in some respects, there was data scarcity. There was also you were allowed to have some lag time between when you saw something versus do something for the most part. Whereas now we're in an era of what I would call a data deluge. We're still lacking on actionable intelligence in some respects, but there's plenty of data out there. And lag time is not always a luxury. Something half a world away can possibly affect you 2 to 3 minutes later. And so we have to sort of think about the nature of how we govern, some of which is done by government. But increasingly, the other thing is, I'd say, is, you know, the great success is we now have transnational entities, both private sector and nonprofits, that span the planet. And what is their role in the ecosystem as well? And so one of the things I think would be a worthwhile conversation to have is not just the role of governing and governments, but the right level as well. If you think about what's happened in the private sector, we've seen unprecedented change where in the 1950s and 1960s, the average time that a company had been listed on the stock market was upwards of 50 years. Now that's less than 11 years. And so companies are coming and going with increasing fluidity. I don't think any of us are saying we want our nation state to come and go with increasing fluidity. That would be bad. But we need to start thinking about What is the role of governing that includes those that have signed up to be pure public servants and serve in that role, but also those that may be sort of doing it maybe as a reservist? I think we need to have a civilian reservist corps, quite frankly. I think the success of the United States is we don't ask much of our citizens. You don't have to vote. Really, the only things we ask that you have to do is make sure you pay your taxes and serve on a jury, none of which people really love. And so it may create this us versus them tension, which is not great. And so can we think about something that's more of it, if you feel like it, you can get involved at the local level, you can get involved at the state level, you can get involved at the federal level, and you can be something where you have a day job, but you also have something where once a month or something like that, you actually feel some affiliation of giving back. And that's what I also start, we need to think about how do we involve citizen scientists, that it's not just sort of the domain of those that are just in the full-time profession as a civil servant. We need to think about more of a rotating career progression, that there's going to be some people that sign up like all of us, and you're going to do 20 to 30 years, great. But there may be other people that say, look, I'm coming in to do my 3 to 4 years, and then I'm going back, and that's okay. And maybe I'm going to come back 3 or 4 years later or something like that. But, you know, sort of the idea that we need to have fluidity in what governance do. And I think, again, the greatest success of the United States, you don't have to do much for your country. The greatest weakness of the United States, you don't have to do a lot for your country. And so I think we have to figure out how we can make it more of a pull to be involved and change the conversation between, well, that's something that the folks in DC are doing, to that's something that's actually all of us and we have a way of doing it. And that's going to be hard, because the strength of the United States is we allow a plurality of opinions. There are definitely a plurality of opinions here. And that's okay. And actually, I take heart that in 2002, there actually was research done with the National Academies of Science that shows a combination of perspectives actually result in better outcomes than just experts alone. And so if we can take that to heart, even though it sometimes feels very painful when like expertise is being questioned, and say, look, we want to allow for a plurality of perspectives. That said, I've worked later with the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence and Tom Malone. A plurality of perspectives only help you if you have shared goals. And so I think the thing that we need to be asking of our leaders, whether they be leaders at the national level, state level, or local level, is can we create big enough shared goals that everyone can actually find a part of that tent, even if we disagree about how to go about doing it?
That's such an interesting thought, to have these shared goals across these diverse communities, urban versus rural and so on. And as I grew up farming and ranching, David, and so the lenses that I see the world through often touch food production and natural ecosystems. And what we see in the rural communities is a very different perspective in how the rural and urban worlds engage. And we, as we learn from biology, the biodiversity itself is what gives a system its resilience and its ability to continue to evolve. And so how do we work together then to embrace privacy and freedom of speech in this new ecosystem when we are working with these diverse communities? And are there certain data sets that we need that would bring these communities together? And if this is a multifactorial question here, but you know, along those same lines, what are the first Earth system sensor networks you would establish if you could do this?
Yep. Great question. And I love the multifactorial questions. Those are the fun ones. And so I would say we need new models to experiment together. And I think if there's anything that's become a challenge for both the public sector and the private sector, is it's been a lot harder to take risks. There was this thing called Project Corona, which I imagine some of you and your audience probably know, but not everybody. Project Corona in 1959 was a classified US government effort to launch a satellite that would take photos of the Soviet Union and then parachute the satellite canister, film canister, back down and either be picked up by a plane or helicopter. The first 13 rockets back in 1959, 1960 exploded on the launch pad. It wasn't until rocket attempt number 21 that they finally succeeded. And later that was declassified in the 1990s. It was bought by a private company called Keyhole LC. Keyhole LC was bought by Google, and it became the basis of Google Earth. And so people gave credit to Google Earth, but I'm like, let's go back a little bit earlier. But I raise that because imagine if we tried to do Project Corona nowadays. It probably wouldn't be rocket explosion number 4 or 5 before there would be congressional hearings saying, what's going on here? Waste of taxpayer dollars. It's never going to work. And they'd scrub the effort. And we'd be out something that both helped us in the Cold War, but later had massive civilian applications for understanding the planet and GPS and everything like that. So where are the places that we can take informed risks together and do so collectively without someone saying we got to scrub that at rocket attempt number 4 or 5 before actually realizing that we'll succeed by number 14? And I would say As I look around, the private sector right now, they've got to show returns to their shareholders. They've got to return profits. That is risky. No one wants to be Xerox PARC, which failed to capitalize on its ideas. No one wants to be that. At the same time, government, we have massive oversight, which we should have. But there are times when we need to do these things because nobody else is doing it. And so I look around and I say, do we need do we need nonprofits that are willing to not just admire the problem? I think we have a whole cottage industry, and I say this because I've worked for a few of them, not ones that I'm currently with, but ones in the past that are really good at writing papers, admiring the issues, moving into the next one, and doing the same thing over and over again. What I don't see are operational places that actually say, I'm going to take on a new mission to involve the community, to involve in the question you're asking, can I do data cooperatives at the local level where, you know, the reality is people's own data. As much as we want to say your data is valuable, it's not until it's valuable with other people. But could we have data cooperatives that you could buy in, and then you could actually express the will of the cooperative and say, look, I am willing to have, as part of this cooperative, my data can be used for research purposes, but cannot be used for the other purposes. Or if it's used for profit purposes, some revenue sharing goes back to the cooperative itself, and it's shared amongst the participants. I think we have to do that, because guess what? If we don't do that, autocracies will show a different model of data privacy, which is you have no privacy and all your data belongs to the autocracy. We have to show a better model. And I remind people, when the Constitution was signed, Ben Franklin said he could rest easy that the great American experiment will exist for the next 50 years. We are way past 50 years now. And so, but he used the word experiment. That experiment uses the word experia. Experia means out of danger. We've got to do dangerous things because experiments don't always work out. But I feel like right now, our greatest Achilles heel as a nation, as a planet, is we made it so that nobody's willing to try new things because they're worried about what's going to happen to their reputation or their career. And I'm like, we need to create those safe spaces. And maybe those safe spaces are nonprofits that are chartered with government approval that involve the private sector. So they're not putting the private sector out of business. But if successful, then they can spin out and then become private enterprises from there. So the last thing I'll end with for your listeners is to remind them that FAIL is an acronym. They just didn't teach you this. FAIL is an acronym meaning first attempt at iterative learning. There will be a second attempt and third attempt and fourth attempt, but we've got to do iterative learning. Otherwise, we're just going to keep on doing what we always did.
There's so much in everything in the last two responses, David. One is this fractal innovation and fractional support to shared goals. And then what you just said about revenue sharing in a cooperative manner. New technologies we've been researching with the NASA team, obviously future of work, blockchain technologies, digital exhaust and profile. There's this seemingly this tension as we're talking about, right? And I think it's a healthy tension of, does the platform benefit more than the individual? Does the individual or the platform need one or the other? I've always kind of go back to Joe Rogan and Spotify and Neil Young when they had that dust up. Okay, does Spotify need Joe Rogan and Neil Young, or does Neil Young and Joe Rogan need Spotify, right? And so there's this healthy tension, and I think we're getting after some of this, which is you even mentioned it too about the how many companies are still around. There's 49 companies still around in the Fortune 500 since 1955, right?
Right.
And when I pulled that article up, it talks about the creative destruction that's required for economic prosperity. And that's why we don't see the longevity there. But to your point, we're seeing this hyper-individualized and localized capability. You see private institutions going in and trying to capture revenue off of that and then creating new tensions. But then that's just kind of micro sites out of the overall organism and the overall system that you're looking at. So just curious, when you're looking at that overall system, it sounds if instrumented, like you said, and then you can start to see anomalies and detect those, you can also provide inputs to help benefit the health of that overall organism. Is it kind of making sense here?
You are making, spot on. So essentially, you want to be able to instrument the system in a way that preserves privacy. And again, I was giving examples where we're looking at aggregate behaviors, not individual behaviors. I mean, I don't know whose car was reflecting. I just know there's more cars. And there's other examples you can do too. If you monitor wastewater, it's not going to say it was your waste that actually gave this public health signal or something like that. So I would want to do things keeping with US values of privacy is important. And even more important, data integrity. It's a word that hasn't really come into fruition, but the idea that you should have consent and actually have the ability to steer your data to goals that you want is also important. And then, like you said, once we do that sort of instrumentation, then we can look for what I would say coalescent behavior that is not something we would predict. And so it could be coalescent behavior, it could be natural, it could be things are clustering because there's going to be this impact. It could also be human activity. For example, I'll give you an example of coalescent behavior that is malfeasant. There are some actors that when a hurricane comes, will ship all their goods, their old goods, to where the hurricane is, precisely so they can then do an insurance claim once it happens. Well, if you see that, you're probably like, yes, probable insurance fraud, and the taxpayer insurance people shouldn't pay for that. But that's only if you can see that type of behavior. There's other examples of coalescent behavior where it's actually useful. For example, when COVID-19 happened, there was initially a push to get testing sites throughout the country. And so people were putting testing sites, state officials were deciding to put testing sites where people lived. Unfortunately, there were some parts of the country where people lived was not where they actually worked. And so there were some reports that were actually, it was the wrong conclusion of what the data was showing. They concluded that certain groups of people were resistant to getting tested. But in fact, they had put the testing sites where they lived as opposed to where they work. And if you have a 45-minute commute each day and where you work is far away, you're not getting tested, not because you don't want to, it's just the testing site's in the wrong spot. And as soon as the state officials updated their practices to where people actually worked, there was no hesitancy shown in testing. But it was one of those cases where you have to ask the second and third order effect, which is, I'm not seeing getting testing. Is it because people are hesitant? Or have I reached the wrong conclusion, which is I simply placed the testing sites in the wrong place? And so I'd use the system to preserve privacy, but look for coalescent behaviors that don't match what I predict. That's what I would call advanced anomalies. And from there, whether it's natural or human, what are the things that as a community we can do to shape the behaviors we do want? In this case, people getting more tests and so they would understand their health status. But there may also be other things where we want to create jobs. For example, I don't think any of us would walk into a coal mining town or an oil mining town and say, you have to stop today. That would be, they'd probably look at us and say, no, I've been doing it for the last three generations. Who are you to come and tell me that? But if instead we say, let's begin to make it so that you are actually, your oil or your coal is more competitive. And the reality is actually our extractive industry currently in the United States is greener than the extractive industry of other countries. And so I get, we've got to make a move to being decarboned and everything like that, but it's going to take some transition. And if we collectively use the diplomatic apparatus of our country to convince the rest of the world that each year we're going to insist on greener and greener extractive industries, one, it would create jobs here in the short term. It would actually create a market for technology that actually is cleaner extraction. And it's not like if we stop our extractive industries today, that industry is not going to be buying it from other countries that happen to be dirtier in the extractive industries. I mean, that still exists. And so I would have a simultaneous push that actually could maybe unite both sides of the aisle. Maybe I'm predicting too much, which is, yes, we're going to be pushing for greener and greener tech and greener extraction. But at the same time, we're going to have transition plans for those places that do oil or coal, that one, they've got jobs in the short term because they are cleaner. And then we're going to actually be moving to other industries that are safer that they can also do locally there. So you're not going into a community and saying, all your jobs are gone tomorrow. Instead is, we have a plan, jobs will be fluent here, and you'll be able to transition to something that is future ready for the world, where the world is going.
The frontier, the new frontier.
Well, and this is the hard thing. I mean, it would be easy if it weren't for people, I would say. And I mean, while we've been talking about technologies, I think that's where a science of systems is necessary because, and again, I say this with all love to my economic brethren, economics was developed 150 years ago when you couldn't make assessments of the real-time buying behaviors, transaction behaviors of people. So you had to guess. And they initially based them off gas laws that were later disproven. But, you know, the whole buy, sell, commerce, it's kind of similar to gas laws, and there's a reason why. And now we actually have the ability to see if what economic theory predicts matches macro behaviors. And the bad news is they took 10 classic predictions of macroeconomics. They actually had people play the game, and it was only accurate. It had an R square, so it meant it was only accurate about 30% of the time. Oh, so good news, we didn't blow ourselves up with the Cold War using game theory. But that said, we probably need a better science, one that is informed by how people actually behave at the aggregate level. And again, this is why I think it's so important that we as the United States take a lead, because this is easy for autocracies to do. They can instrument and do surveillance and understand their behaviors. We don't want that future. I think we are strongly against that future. But if we also don't develop a science of systems that understands the decision-making ability of communities, of states, of the world as a whole, and do so in a way that also still respects privacy and informed consent, then we're going to be behind the curve when it comes to tackling the challenges we're facing now as a planet. So we have to evolve a science of systems. And yes, it involves the natural ecosystem. Yes, it involves technology, but it also has to involve the really messy and thorny part, which is humans.
It seems like what it's really coming back to is that time continuum. As you mentioned, in the early 1900s, even mid-century, you had some benefit of time, but now things that would take a couple days are taking a couple minutes and even fractions of seconds in some of these transactions. And because we have adopted these technologies and that time continuum, we have to now figure out what the science of that new time continuum is.
Yeah. I mean, packet latency back in the 1700s was about 14 days on horseback between New York and DC. Now packet latency is milliseconds. So yeah, we have to figure out how do we provide both individuals, but also communities and nation state leaders, the tools to better understand what are the pros and cons of taking path A versus path B versus path C. And right now, we lack those tools. And so my pitch for a science of systems is this will give you more in-depth insights to the pros and cons of any decision you're about to make.
John, you have any other questions? I know we have others, but I want to make sure I don't just keep asking.
There's so many things that bubble right to mind. And if we take this to the next step, if we imagine the scenario where we have a system of systems operating, collecting data, who runs it? Who yep manages it?
Well,
who turns the dials and pulls the levers?
So I think if we were keeping with the US's value, and I think that's again where I'm proud of the United States, I also can recognize both our strengths and weaknesses. And I think our strengths is we encourage individualism. Our challenges, we encourage individualism. And some of these problems are bigger than one person. And so what I would say is if we were to do it consistent with US values, it's got to be as many people who want to get involved can. And that's why I look to citizen science as an example. And what do I mean by that? If one instruments the planet, and I would start with it's interesting. So when severe acute respiratory syndrome happened in 2003, when it finally came to the forefront, in the aftermath, there were several large US companies that approached the Centers for Disease Control at the time and said, we'd be willing to pay you upwards of $2 to $3 billion to prevent a second SARS. And of course, the US government's like, aside from receiving corporate taxes, I don't know how to take your money. But what if you actually pull together private industry to say, look, what happened with COVID, it decimated industries, it sent both communities backwards, it sent private sector and economies backwards. Could we actually have a nonprofit that would have both government participation, but also private sector participation to begin to look for identifying yet specific enough signals to get ahead of future pandemics? And I think we can. I mean, there's plenty of proof points. I mean, we've already shown, for example, we can pick up cholera from space. And so if we can see cholera from space on the ground, there's other tells that we could have that could inform of future outbreaks. And so I would initially have it be a coalition of the willing for industry. And maybe that's a US-led coalition. Maybe we do involve other countries who want to get involved. And what we're saying is there will be no delay between what any of the participants are seeing in the system. Because if you go back to what happened with SARS, again, we knew about it 5.5 months before China said anything. Each time we knew about it, we asked the US State Department to ask China. And I understand in China, because of their history, public health is a national security concern, but each time they said nothing's going on over here. And that's what really sort of hurt folks, is that with public health events, the longer you wait, the larger the impact. And if you can get closer to the curve, that's where you can actually make a big difference. And so you would say anybody participating both can contribute, but also see what's being seen. And then what you're essentially saying is now we have this sort of crowdsourced inputs as to the health of the planet on a daily basis. You can imagine then academics will start analyzing the data and publishing papers about it. Governments will be watching it. Insurance companies will be using the data because it'll inform them as to what their risk profile is. And if they can get you to get health treatment sooner, then you're less likely to get severely sick and therefore not be a large claim. And so it's actually sort of, it's like all of us are involved. And I would say in terms of the governance approach, I would start with a board that includes representatives of each of the different disciplines. And then you'd also have to have, at the community level, representatives that are almost serving on a jury-based approach, where it's like, congratulations, if you're willing to serve, you've got 1 year or 2 years to serve on this jury for your locality, and your job is to represent the will of this locality because you are meant to be a jury of your peers for what the state of Arizona or the state of California or the state of Montana is willing to contribute to the system. And you get a year or two to do it, and then you wrote down. And so that would be in keeping with US values. Obviously, a little bit more complicated than simply being a dictator and saying, I'm going to do this by force. But I think we owe it to future generations to show that we can handle the complicated approach. And if you remember the Federalist Papers, because I'm a big fan of the Federalist Papers, specifically Federalist Papers number 51 said they wanted ambition to counter ambition. And they were talking about how you had checks and balances in the system. I think a science of systems approach would inform how we put checks and balances in the system so that no one party has outsized influence. But at the same time, we're mindful of there are going to be different goals of different people in the system, and that's okay.
Yeah, governance is messy. We're seeing Bitcoins having the same discussion right now, right? It was supposed to be decentralized and the shared governance. And there's talk already starting to kind of have difficulty in how to govern the release of new tokens and everything. So yeah, I don't think it's any system. I do agree with you. I think it's either autocratic or democratic in its nature. And you are going to have competing interests. Just as we see right now in a capitalist society, right? Profit incentive versus societal wellness. And you're going to have a healthy tension there, right? And so the governance piece is, and I'm so glad John brought that up, because that's what we've really been looking at, is this corporate governance, the societal governance. But really, it comes to what you're really speaking to is really is transparency of the data, data security, data privacy. And I know there's some missions out there right now through ISACs, information sharing consortiums, that are looking at it this way of how do we bring this data together. And even in Air Force, when I was in the Air Force, we started a unit called the TAP Lab. And it was to indicate that we were going to open the tap to the data for OPIR. So academics and other business partners could go out and use the data in new ways to benefit society. We didn't want to keep it in a closed system. So how do you look at closed systems versus open systems? And let's compare China as a closed system and maybe not being able to know exactly what's going on there versus a transparent system of systems, and then the interaction of those two systems together.
Yep. So I'll first tackle closed systems. So China is a more closed system, and there's reasons why. I mean, 1.3 billion people, it's a lot. They've been around for 3,000 years. We talk about our country and we think about our country as existing for a long time. We're nowhere near how long China has existed. They've had at least five revolutions, if not more, depending on what you call a revolution. And their version of revolutions took upwards of 100 years. They were not things that were super empowering. If anything, they sent their culture briefly backwards. So it's interesting when you talk about revolution in the United States, that's what gave birth to us. Whereas to them, they're like, it broke us up. It sent us backwards. It was never good. And so there's different narratives. And so a closed ecosystem like China, and I would say any country for that matter, I would point to a paper that some colleagues, including Dr. Anthony Scripignano and Natalie Baird and myself and others, last year, we actually picked 12 different U.S. military bases, and we looked at just the commercial ecosystem around the base. So not the base itself. The base we assumed was a closed ecosystem, but we wanted to see what was happening commercially around it to see if we could detect disruption to the base. And disruption could be anything from the day a base commander changed to a suspicious package was delivered or something else happened that caused a problem. And sure enough, looking at just the commercial ecosystem, and then after we spotted what we thought were disruptions and going back to the bases, so we did not know if they had experienced disruptions or yet or not. Once we went to them and we say, we spotted it on this date, are we right? And there was even one case where we thought we were wrong because we couldn't find any open source information about it. But then we went to the base commander like, oh yeah, an event happened that day and you're absolutely right. We could spot disruption to the closed ecosystem looking at just the commercial ecosystem around them. And so I would say the good news is, depending on how you look at it, it's getting harder and harder to be a completely closed ecosystem on the planet. That's going to be scary to some regimes of control that are used to it. At the same time, let's fast forward to the United States and think about our more open ecosystem. So when I was with the National Commission that reviewed the research and development programs, it happened to be of the U.S. intelligence community. And one of the questions we asked was, what happens if someone uses our very system of government against us? They figure out our cracks and our seams. Like one of the things we do here in the United States that I'm proud of is we do separate our overseas foreign policy from our domestic policy. But that's also a weakness because we don't have the connectivity that Europe does between what they do overseas and what they do domestically. We also separate, say, our Title 50, that's the intelligence community, from Title 10, that's military. But what if you play that and you make it so it's unclear, is this something that's military versus national security versus law enforcement? And one might say that's being done to us now. The very system of checks and balances we have in this country are being used against us. And the solution, I sure hope not, is, well, forget the checks and balances, because that's a very bad future if that happens. But we've got to understand, how do we upgrade the very system of checks and balances that makes U.S. strong to continue to be an open ecosystem? I give another example, too. Our strength is we have freedom of speech. Our challenge is we have freedom of speech. Depending, there is evidence that shows the tremendous voices associated with anti-vaccination can be attributed to less than 10 people producing 80% of the content. And that's, again, the example of democratization, that when that outsized few people can have that large of a voice, what other things are happening that we think is actually a large group or a large crowd, when in fact it's actually a much smaller group? And I say this with all, I mean, I've worked in public service, I'm a nonpartisan and thus have the scars, But I think even political parties in our country are grappling with this because they're used to having very clear sort of black and white issues. And the world is anything but black and white now. It's shades of gray. It's undergoing huge transformations. And so helping them help themselves understand what should they be having as issues to talk to. I actually was able to get a nonpartisan group of people together recently where it was from both sides of the political aisle. And they said, look, the challenge is it's easy for us to win elections if we play to a very singular message that's to our base. It's a lot harder for us to play if we do the more moderate or the bridge building message. So we're all playing to our bases because it's easy to show we can win that way. It's hard to show if we actually do a more moderate message. That might work for one or two rounds of the game, but now you see what's exactly happening in this country is we're becoming more and more polarized because it's hard to actually show how you can win playing to the middle. And so a science of systems, in my opinion, would figure out what are those safe experiments, and it can't be done by government. I mean, our system of government can't do it, but maybe some foundations, some nonprofits could have at the local level chances to show how you can win by being in the middle and being what politics really should be, which is the art of compromise, as opposed to the art of polarization.
And I love this concept of data democratization and data cooperatives, where everyone is a stakeholder and stands to gain by contributing and participating in the cooperative.
Yep.
And this model is analogous to the early agricultural cooperatives that built the food production systems that have led the world here in the United States.
Right. And I'll do one final close. I would say the U.S. is at its best when we figure out how to take things that the private sector do not currently know how to tackle because they're either too messy or they're hairball sorts of problems. And we find a way through either government incentives or some other entity, as I said, nonprofits, to make the hairball problems tangible enough that the private sector can see a return on investment for tackling it. And so the art for what we need to do in the decade ahead is to, through a combination of government and nonprofit will, take those hairball problems that we think can't be solved and figure out how do we make them tractable enough that the private sector is willing to say, yes, I can take that on because I can see a return on investment.
Fantastic. Well, as everybody can hear, there's a lot to talk about on this topic, and we couldn't be more excited to bring the podcast to you today. We'll be releasing new episodes where we'll be joined by thought leaders like David today, academics, futurists, scientists, and economists who will share their insights and expertise on topics like these shaping our society, economy, and world around us. Please subscribe to the podcast and follow through the link in the profile. Thanks so much today to Dr. David Bray and John Rask from NASA as our co-host today. And we'll see you in the next episode. Thanks so much.